and since light hurt my eyes so badly, I needed to have the room darkened with blackout curtains. The world I lived in when I was asleep was the one that made sense. If my waking world could be considered incoherent, as one doctor put it, then my dream time was a model of coherency. When I was asleep, I was back in the Crystal City, being trained to do the coming, bar, 57, CK, many things that the vision would require me to do. As I slept, I was led to understand electronic circuitry and to recognize the components I would need to make the bed. These dreams went on for several hours each day, for at least 20 days. They were wonderful. My waking world was filled with pain and irritation. My sleeping world was filled with freedom, knowledge, and excitement. Awake, the people around me were only waiting for me to die. Asleep, I was being shown how to live a fruitful life. When I say that the people in the hospital were only waiting for me to die, I'm not being cynical. They never expected me to make it, and they considered me a sort of medical mystery. For instance, a team of specialists came from New York City just to examine me. One of them told me that no one in his memory had survived such a jolt of lightning and that he wanted to examine me while I was still alive. They spent 3 days at the hospital, poking and prodding me as I lay paralyzed. One particularly horrible thing they did was a pincushion test in which they stuck 7-inch long needles into my legs to see if I could feel anything. The amazing thing was that I couldn't feel the needles at all, even though I saw them being inserted into my legs. I was terrified. I must have looked very frightened when they started the pincushion test, because the doctor stopped just before inserting the needle into my leg and looked up at me. I don't yet think he realized that I, 58, knew what was going on. He stood there with rubber gloves on and the needle in his hand and he said, we're going to look for any nerve that is alive in the dot. He then slipped the needle right into my leg. I could see the look of surprise on the faces of the doctors and nurses every time they came into the room and found me still alive. I know they expected my heart to give out or the pain to kill me. And to tell you the truth, the pain was so great that one wanted to die. But I also knew the truth, I was going to survive. My experience in the Crystal City and the dreams I was having every night assured me that I was doomed to live. And the word "doomed" was an accurate description of how I felt about going on. I was in constant agony now. I have often wondered why I couldn't feel the pincushion test. I have come to the conclusion that the pain inside my body was so great that I couldn't feel anything that was being done to it from the outside. After all, how painful can needle sticks be to a person who is burnt from the inside out? The pain was so overwhelming, and I was in such bad shape, that I couldn't imagine healing enough to have a normal life. That is why I felt doomed to be alive. After 8 days flat on my back, I made a discovery. I could move my left hand. I discovered this when my nose began to itch. The pain had subsided, and now I had itchy spots all over me that felt like hives. One of the worst areas was my nose. I had become so accustomed to being paralyzed that I would just lie there and hope that the itching would go, coming, bar, 59, CK, away. It didn't TMT. I began to think about scratching my nose when I realized the fingers of my left hand were moving. With great concentration I began to pull my hand up toward my face. The effort was like lifting a heavy barbell. Several times, I had to stop and rest from the exertion. Finally, after what surely must have been an hour, I reached my nose. The spot was no longer itchy, but I scratched it anyway for Victoria TMS sake. That was when I saw that my fingernails had been burned off by the lightning and were nothing but black stubs. It was time to begin my own rehabilitation. I had decided to make my body work again, one muscle at a time. My brother brought a copy of Grotius Anatomy to the hospital. This book describes the workings of the human body, with detailed written explanations and a line drawing of each body part. My brother made me a headdress out of a coat hanger and a pencil so I could turn the pages with the eraser on the pencil by moving my head. I started looking at every muscle in my hand, examining the picture in the book while I focused on the muscles and tried to move them one at a time. Hour after hour, I stared at Grotius' anatomy and then stared at my hand, talking to it, cursing at it, making it move. When the left hand worked, I did the same thing with the right hand, and so on down my entire body. The greatest moments came when I was able to move a muscle, even as little as an eighth of an inch. When that happened, I knew my body was going to work again. 60. A few days after starting this form of therapy, I decided to get out of bed. I had no hope of walking, at least not yet. All I wanted to do was get out of bed and then get back in under my own power. Late at night, when no nurses were in the room, I rolled out of bed and hit the floor with a sickening thud. Then I struggled to get back into the bed I had just bailed out of. I rolled onto my belly and inched my rear end into the air like a worm. Then I grabbed at the bedsheet bars, the sheet, the mattress, and anything else I could get a palsied grip on. Several times I fell back to the cold floor. Once I fell asleep from exhaustion. But by morning, I was back in bed. Since the nurses checked the patients every 4 hours, I figured the climb back had taken me at least that long. I was as happy and exhausted as a climber who has made it to the top of Mount Everest. I knew I was on the way back. Still, no one else thought one was going to make it. The nurses had looks of despair when they came in to see me. I heard doctors in the hallway say that my heart was too far gone and that I was going to die. Even my family had its doubts. They saw me laboring for breath and struggling to move, and they thought it would be only a short time before I was dead. "Oh, Danyon, you look very good today," my folks would say, but the look on their faces was one of utter horror, as if they were examining a cat squashed in their driveway. I wish I had had a movie camera positioned by my head, to record the people's expressions as they tried to maintain their composure when they saw me. Coming, bar, 61, CK, one day. For example, my aunt came into the room and stood at the foot of the bed. She stared for a minute, until she was joined by her daughter, who stood next to her. "Oh, he looks like Jesus, doesn't he?" I said my aunt. "Oh, he does," I said my cousin. "Oh, he has sort of a glow, like Jesus must have had when they took him down from the cross." Another time, a neighbor came to visit. He entered the room with a big smile on his face, but when he stood over me and looked down, the smile wilted in direct proportion to the pain he must have been feeling in his stomach. The sight of me was making him sick. "Oh, don't you tmt throw up on me," I said. Thankfully, he backed up and left the room. One time a visitor did throw up. I was awakened by someone pulling back my curtain and saying, oh my god. Then they just lost it. They bent over and heaved and continued to heave as they backed out of the room. No one has admitted to doing this, and I still don't yet know who it was. Throughout this horror show I continued to commune with the beings of light. Night after night my dreams showed me my future. I was shown circuitry, building plans, and component parts. I was also given a deadline. I was to have the working model of the center completed by 1992. By the end of September 1975 I was released from the hospital. Against all odds I had survived. The doctors also thought that I would be blinded by the experience, 62, but they were wrong. My eyes had become so sensitive to the light that I had to wear welder TMS goggles outside, but I could still see. None of the doctors thought I would be able to move again, but now, only 13 days after being struck by lightning, I was able to crawl out of bed and drop into a wheelchair. It took me nearly 30 minutes to do it, but I insisted on doing it myself. They also predicted that my heart would stop within a few hours of the lightning strike. But here it was, still beating as they rolled me down the hall and out to the car. Before I left, one of the doctors asked me what this experience had been like. I was slow to respond, but the image that came immediately to mind was that of Joan of Arc. "Feel like God burned me at the stake," I said in a stumbling speech. Then I was wheeled out of the hospital and into a waiting car. 7. At home, I know that Sandy picked me up at the hospital because she told me later that she had. I imagine there was some kind of fanfare when I got home. But I honestly don't yet remember any balloons or signs that said AO welcome home, Danny. I did not yet hear anyone say that I had been sent home to die, but that is what the doctors told my parents and Sandy. AO let him go home and live out his last days, I said one of the doctors. AO here TMLL be more comfortable. The truth was that most of the time I did not yet know if I was in the hospital or out of it. Life was sketchy for me because the nerves in my body were shorted out. Reality came in pieces, like those of a jigsaw puzzle. I knew people and then I didn't TMT know them. I knew where I was and then I was frightened because I was suddenly in a strange place. I was a shell of a person. After being home a couple of days, for example, I found myself sitting at the kitchen table talking to a woman. She was sipping coffee and chattering away about people and events that I knew nothing about. I, 64, liked this woman. She had a familiar way about her and was very pleasant. AO, excuse me, AI interrupted. AO, but who are you? A, there was shock on the woman at TMS face. AO, why, Danyan, EATMM your mother. A, my stamina was also terribly depleted. I was able to stand for perhaps 15 minutes at a time. Sometimes I could walk about 10 steps, but after that I was so exhausted I had to sleep at least 20 hours. When I was asleep, the real action took place. I returned to the Crystal City, where I attended classes taught by the beings of light. These visions were not the same as those in the near-death experience. This time I was aware of my physical body and also of a different way of teaching by the beings. When I was in a spirit form, I was bathed in knowledge and had only to think about something to understand it. These classroom sessions were different in that I had to struggle to learn my lessons. The struggle came in the way the class was taught. I was shown the equipment I was supposed to build, but I wasn't TMT told much about it. Instead, I watched as the spirit beings operated the equipment. It was up to me to learn how to build it by deduction. I was shown the seven components of the bed, for example, but was not told their names. And I saw how the eight parts of the centers worked, but I was not given a technical manual showing how to put them together. This method of learning by watching and deduction, at home, 65, made my mission an extremely difficult one. It also left me with some puzzles that I have yet to solve. At one point, for instance, I was given a tour of the operating room of the future. There were no scalpels or sharp instruments in this operating room. Instead, all healing was done by special lights. Patients were given medications and exposed to these lights, said a being who was with me, and that changed the vibration of cells within the body. Every part of the body has its own vibratory rate, said the being. When that rate changes, certain illnesses take place. These lights return a diseased organ to its proper vibratory rate, healing whatever illness was plaguing it. These medical visions were given to me as visions of a distant future. They didn't TMT relate to my mission of building the centers other than to show the effects of stress on the human organism. I was lucky to have such a rich spiritual life because my physical life was a shambles. 2 months after the accident, I was sleeping far less but still had to struggle to do ordinary things. Just to get out of bed and into the living room required the planning of a major trip. For a while, I tried to walk down the hall, but I kept blacking out and waking up with my face pressed against the floor. One morning I got out of bed and fell against the floor. I must have hit hard because, when I woke up, a puddle of blood was streaming from my broken nose. The accident dazed me so much that I lay there the entire day, until Sandy came home. 66. On a typical morning I would wake up well past 8 o'clock, after Sandy had left for work. It took me as long as an hour and a half to get out of bed, since the long hours of sleep had left my muscles sore and tight. After getting down on all fours, I would crawl on my belly to the living room and spend my day sitting on the couch, too exhausted to move. I often went in my pants because I was too tired and slow to make it to the toilet in time. When I ate the food that Sandy left for me on the coffee table, I always used a spoon. When I used a fork, I simply couldn't find my mouth, and I invariably stuck myself in the eye or forehead with it. The first time this happened, I was trying to eat a piece of chicken and poked myself so hard in the forehead that I drew blood. I couldn't eat anything tricky like peas, because I was so shaky that they rolled off the spoon and onto the floor. Most days I sat in the living room and did nothing. I didn't listen to music or watch television, and I was so ashamed at being unable to remember my friends' ATM names that I didn't ask them to come over and visit. Most of the time I didn't mind being alone. The more time I spent alone, the more time I had to think about the visions. Alone in the living room or on the front porch, I would churn over the material from the nightly sessions with my spirit teachers. I would continuously do mathematical calculations in my mind and process the information that came into it. At times I joked that I was going to get smart enough to build the Starship Enterprise. It was good that I had a constant stream of visions, at home, 67, because I had nothing else to entertain me. I rarely went anywhere because the effort was so great. And if I did, I ran the risk of having blackout spells. Sometimes these could be quite embarrassing. On New Year at EMS Eve, for example, Sandy and I went to a Chinese restaurant to celebrate. I was determined to make it into the restaurant under my own power, and I wouldn't let her roll me in a wheelchair. From a parking spot for the handicapped, I made my way slowly across the parking lot using two walking sticks. I called this a crabbing, a because I looked like a half-dead crab with big pincers dragging itself across dry land. It took between 10 and 20 minutes to get into the restaurant, and by then I was breathing heavily from exhaustion. We were seated immediately, but I still couldn't catch my breath. Sandy ordered wonton soup while I sat there panting like a dog. I tried to carry on a conversation with Sandy, even though I could see the fear in her eyes over the distress that I was experiencing. The waiter delivered two piping hot bowls of the soup to our table. I looked down at the soup and then suddenly I was in it. I had blacked out and fallen face first into the bowl. At first Sandy thought it was a joke, but when I began to sputter and cough, she screamed and pulled my head up. Soup ran out of my nose and across the tablecloth. The waiter held me upright in the chair until I regained consciousness, and then the restaurant staff helped me get back into the car. Even going outside on my own had its risks. One day I decided to spend the morning sitting in the sun. I, 68, crawled my way through the house and out to the backyard. Slowly I stumbled to a chair in the middle of the yard. I was exhausted and drenched in sweat by the time I got to it. I groped for the armrests, and like an old man, began easing myself into it. The next thing I knew, I was flat on my face in the grass. I had blacked out again and was unable to get up. I lay there for 6 hours, until Sandy came home to pick me up. In that period of time I tried to find deep pleasure in examining the grass and dirt. Perhaps the worst of these blackouts came when I went out to the car to get a magazine that I had left on the front seat. I grabbed the door, pulled it open and collapsed. When I awoke, my hand was stuck in the door handle and I was hanging by my hand with my shoulder out of socket. I had to dangle there for 3 hours until someone came to help. By the end of 1975 I was broke. My hospital bills and loss of income exceeded $100,000, and the debt was climbing with each passing day. To pay my bills I was forced to sell everything I owned. All of my cars went Fista 5 peak condition antique automobiles sold to the highest bidder. Since I couldn't work, I had to sell my interest in my business, too. The nature of the independent contracting that I did for the government changed. I had worked in security, a job that required me to be inconspicuous and fast. There was no opening for a half-blind person who walked like a crippled crab. Now I was limited to office work. Leaving the field work didn't bother me too much. Although it was, at home, 69, much more exciting than life in the office, It carried with it many bad memories. As I saw in my near-death experience, I had done many things to hurt people through the years. After reliving those events, I did not want any more of them to mar my record. As I told anyone who would listen, be careful what you do in life, because you have to see yourself do it again when you die. The difference is that this time you are on the receiving end. We moved to another house because living in the old one served as a constant reminder of the lightning strike. So potent were the memories that I never went back into the bedroom where the strike occurred. I insisted that Sandy keep that door shut, and I refused to go anywhere near it, even though it was the largest bedroom in the house. Before selling the house, I had the carpet changed in the bedroom. I had to have this done since an imprint of my feet was burned into it, which would have lowered the value of the house in much the way that the white outline of a homicide victim would. When the workman pulled the carpet up, I was sitting on the living room sofa. I heard one of them whistle and the other one say, "Oh, look at that." Then one of them came out with a grin on his face and said, "Oh, TMS black lines all across the floor where the electricity snaked out and found the nails." I had only a passing interest in the fact that I was broke. We received help from my parents and Sandy had a job, but I had lost everything I ever had to that bolt of 70 lightning. By the time I became productive again, I had spent tens of thousands of dollars on medical bills. I haven't a TMT paid them off yet. All I could think about were the centers that the being had revealed to me. The centers were my destiny, they were what I was supposed to do. I had to build these centers, but I didn't TMT know how I was going to do it. I talked constantly about AF centers, to myself and to anyone who would listen and even those who wouldn't TMT. They were the meaning of my life, and I had to get them built. I began to talk in detail about what had happened when I died, or at least I tried to talk in detail. Much of what I said in those days was hard for people to understand. It was clear in my head. But when it came out of my mouth, there were large pieces missing that made it sound as though I were speaking nonsense. Nonetheless, I continued to talk about the whole experience, from leaving my body and visiting this heavenly place to seeing the future in boxes and finding out that I was destined to build these centers. I described all of this in detail because it was so firmly planted in my brain that there was no other way to explain it. I explained the centers at TM 8 steps more times than I can remember. I told people about the boxes and the visions of the future that they held. These centers can change the future, I said. They can reduce stress and fear, which cause many of the world at TMS problems. The more I talked, the more I felt people pulling away from me. Even Sandy was becoming more distant, and frankly, I couldn't TMT blame her. She was a beautiful, at home, 71, young woman with a long life ahead of her. Why should she squander it on a man who walked like a crab and babbled about heavenly stress reduction projects? And my friends, guys I had played football and drunk beer with for years, were now listening to me talk like a messiah. One of them hit it on the head when he said I sounded like a retarded fundamentalist. That is exactly what I sounded like. They had never heard of a near-death experience, so they didn't TMT have an inkling as to what had gone on. In fact, I had never heard of a near-death experience. But I knew there was a great and powerful and glorious God, and I knew that the world on the other side was magnificent. In this world, I was living, breathing, and feeling the pain of the world. I also knew that through love and God, I could work my way out of this pain. No one could tell me that the centers would not TMT work, even if they were just a vision at that point. I knew they could, because I had been every one of the people who could be helped by them. There was nothing anyone could tell me about pain. There was nothing anyone could tell me about mental anguish. I knew about pain and horror as no one knows it. And I knew that the centers were the answer to helping mankind. One day someone asked me why I didn't TMT commit suicide. I can't TMT remember who it was, but I do remember telling them the whole story as I have recounted it up to now, and they're saying, Danyan, if it was so great up there, why don't you TMT you kill yourself? I-72, I wasn't EMT angered by the question at all. In fact, it was a very logical one, especially given the fact that I spend my waking hours singing the praises of the afterlife. Why didn't EMT I kill myself? Until that point I hadn't EMT really thought about it. Sitting there on the porch like a zombie, I began to realize the change that had taken place in me as a result of the near-death experience. Regardless of my condition, the experience gave me the inner strength to endure. In my worst moments, all I had to do was recall the love that I felt emanating from those heavenly lights and I could press on. I knew that it would be wrong to take my own life, but the fact is, I never even thought of doing so. When things got bad, all I had to do was think of the love in that light and they got better. When I say things got better, I mean that they got better somewhere deep inside of me, in a place that would let me live with this adversity. To the outside world, I was a different story. I could barely walk and had difficulty seeing. I had to wear welding goggles in the daytime and I weighed 155 pounds, about 70 pounds under my normal weight. My body was bent so that I looked like a question mark. I ranted and raved like a religious madman, talking about spiritual beings, a city of light, boxes with visions of the future, and, of course, the centers. I sounded mad and probably should have been committed to a mental hospital. I might have been, too, had I not seen an article in the newspaper that changed my life again. 8. A saving grace. The article was no longer than 4 paragraphs, but reading those words changed my life every bit as much as the lightning bolt. They said simply, Dr. R. Raymond Moody will be speaking at the University of South Carolina on AO What Happens to Some People Who Have Been Declared Clinically Dead But Survived. A. Moody, at the time, a Georgia psychiatrist, has been analyzing case studies of people who have almost died, only to return from their brush with death to talk about seeing dead relatives, beings of light and having their life pass before them in review. Moody calls this phenomenon a near-death experience, and says it may happen to thousands of people who have brushes with death. I was excited. For the first time since being struck by lightning, I realized that I was not alone. After reading these few paragraphs, I understood that other people, 74, had been up that tunnel and seen the beings of light, too. I even had a name for what had happened at a near-death experience. I looked at the date of the talk and realized it was only 2 days away. I had left the house only a few times since coming home, and those had been embarrassing incidents. But I decided I had to see Dr. Moody at TMS presentation. If nothing else, I had to talk to someone who truly understood what I was going through. Even though 1975 is not that long ago, it was the dark ages for people who had had near-death experiences. Doctors knew little or nothing about them and would usually dismiss them as bad dreams or hallucinations if they were mentioned by patients. If a patient persisted in talking about his experience, he was generally referred to a psychiatrist. Instead of listening and trying to understand, many psychiatrists medicated patients who had experienced these spiritual events. Clergymen were of surprisingly little help, usually considering these spiritual journeys to be the work of the devil. There are many stories that illustrate the poor handling of these experiences, but one of the most interesting to me was that of a soldier in the Korean War who nearly died in combat. He had a concussion, resulting from an enemy artillery barrage, and was taken to the hospital with very serious head injuries. Shortly after the explosion occurred, he left his body and drifted above the battlefield. He saw himself surrounded by other dead and wounded soldiers and began to feel sorry for his friends as well as for the enemy. A saving grace, 75. Then he felt himself accelerating into a dark place and heading for a bright light. When he reached the light he got soaked in good feelings. He had a review of his life that still leaves him stupefied for its vivid detail. It was like a movie that was being watched by every sense in my body, he said. At the end of his review he was given a special message. Just love everybody, a voice said in his head. Then he came back to life. Within a couple of days he began talking about his experience, first to doctors and nurses, and then to other patients. The problem was, he talked too much. The doctors, who knew nothing about near-death experiences, referred him to military psychiatrists, who had no knowledge of them either.